Hello, hello. Welcome to the 1 year anniversary of Pushing Cardboard. I'm your pusher, Grant Lindeberg, and this is episode 14. Happy anniversary, Steve Carey. No deep dive into a game again this time. Sorry about that. I promise I'll get back to it next episode. But as we've hit the 1 year mark, I thought it might be a good time to look back at the past year. And I also have a great interview with Steve Carey, designer of the recently released A Greater Victory. From Revolution Games, it takes the blind sword system to the Battle of South Mountain. And Steve talks about many of the other things he's involved with in the hobby and his long history in it. So no deep dive this time again. Sorry about that to deep dive lovers, but I promise, even though there's probably an interview again next episode, I'll squeeze in a dive into one game for sure next time. It's been another good month on the website. Last episode's interview with Kai Jensen was a big success, and it's brought in many new listeners. So thanks to Kai, and thanks to all the new folks checking out our corner of the wargame world. And also thanks to Brant from the Armchair Dragoons, who had me on his podcast recently to talk about GMT West. He puts out a great podcast. I recommend checking it out if you haven't already. I imagine most of you have. And they have a couple of great resources on their website if you haven't checked that out. They have a convention calendar that tries to list all the conventions, all the action in one place, so you can see what's going on near you or far away, or just, you know, tap in to see what's going on. And then every Tuesday, they do Tuesday News Day. They do a roundup of all the news, mostly tabletop, but also some on minis and even some on computer war games. In terms of news, this episode, not a ton of news to talk about. There's been a lot of new Kickstarters. I've backed the new version of Kingmaker. I'm not exactly sure why, as I don't often get the chance to play multiplayer games, especially not face-to-face, but I don't know. I guess I just wanted to see what they've done with it. They've been talking about it for a long time, and now here it's finally coming. So if you're interested, it's I think they're called Gibson Games, and you can look for it on Kickstarter. I also backed a new World War II project from Dissimula, but they've canceled the Kickstarter. Sounds like it was the right idea, as the designer wasn't happy where it was, and he didn't want to rush it. I'm sure they're going to relaunch this one, and I'm sure I'll back it the second time as well, because I really liked the first game I got with them. Also, a couple big sales to pass along. GMT has their annual event where they reward folks who have ordered through their P500 system. For every game you got in the last year via P500, you can order a game from GMT at 50% off. So that's a heck of a good deal. If you've already got good deals on the P500, then you always get more good deals on their back catalog. So check that out. And if you want to check out Steve Carey's new game, A Greater Victory, that we're going to talk about later, it's on sale at Revolution Games, along with most of their catalog. And most of their games are also available in boxed or Ziploc versions, so you can really get some great games at great prices at Revolution. Oh, and wait, of course, the biggest news. My shelves came back in stock at IKEA. Yay! So I finally got my games back off the floor, and things are looking great. I'll have to do another one of those shelfy videos soon. I did one way back, I don't know, probably 6-9 months ago, and it was great fun. And then I couldn't do one forever because my games were in such a disarray. But now I can do it, so that'll have to be my next video project. In terms of what's on the table, I'm scaling the PBM stuff back just a bit. Particularly in games that I've played a ton. I still have a fair amount of Commands and Colors going on, as well as ASL, so I guess there's still that in terms of stuff I played a ton. But I've got a couple games of Death of an Army. I'm still playing Absolute War. We're moving on to the second scenario. I'm playing Bayonets and Tomahawks, and for the first time I've got an opponent who's not totally digging it, so we'll see if he comes around or if it bounces off him. Not everything is for everyone. But I'm scaling back just a bit because it just I don't have time to play as many PBEM games and do all the podcasting and video stuff that I want to get to. So, you know, I'm going to go from 14 to 11 or something. I don't know. It's not. Hopefully, it'll make a difference, but it's not going to slow me down that much. In terms of new games to the collection, once again, I'm happy to report no new additions. I'm still digging through all the stuff from the GMT West as well as a Greater Victory that I got from Revolution. So I've still got plenty on my table. In terms of looking back on my first year, I have to say I've had a great time doing this. In addition to the podcast, I've set up a channel for YouTube videos and I have a website if you haven't seen it. The podcast has steadily increased in popularity along its first 13 episodes. It really feels like it's gaining a base of listeners, which I totally appreciate. The YouTube stuff feels more sort of a la carte. There's plenty of subscribers there now, but most folks I find are just picking what they want from what I post. So some videos get 2,000 watches and some just 200. It all depends on the topic, which sort of makes sense as each video is just on a single topic and you can be more focused in your search on YouTube and as that's just the way that works. The website has been a pleasant surprise as there's usually been an online response to the podcast, either in the website forums or on the comments on the website. So, it's great to get the feedback as well as the ideas for what to do next. And there's definitely lots of anonymous comments, which are fine, but lots of people who take the time to log in so that I know it's them and they're regular commenters or posters or keep giving me feedback, a lot of which is like, make longer episodes. I'm doing the best I can. Anyway, to sum it up, it's been a very fun first year of doing this. I'm hyper aware that podcasters burn out easily, and I hope that doesn't happen to me. I'm going to go for as long as I can to keep it up. I've enjoyed participating in the hobby in this way, and I've been rewarded by meeting new people and listeners. So full steam ahead for now. Okay, anyway, instead of a dive into a game, as I said, here's my interview with Steve Carey. I hope you enjoy it. All right, welcome back to Pushing Cardboard. I'm here with Steve Carey. Hello, Steve.
Hi.
And we're both at GMT's Weekend at the Warehouse. This can't be. Where are you from? Where do you live, Steve?
I'm from Southern California, and I've been going to the GMT West Weekend since the inception.
So how many years has it been then?
Oh, it's 20-something plus
years. First time for me, obviously, but that's wonderful. Do you go to a lot of conventions, or you know, as a player, designer, or publisher, or whatever, you know, what all the hats you wear? Is it just this, or just California stuff, or do you get around a lot?
Mostly West Coast type things. I've been to PacificCon twice. I enjoy Historicon that Harold Buchanan does.
Right, San Diego.
Down in San Diego in November. I used to go to Strategicon quite a bit. I haven't been in a couple of years. That's in Los Angeles.
Right.
Three times a year. And, of course, my mainstay is here, GMT, twice a year. And I also went out to Dice Tower West Las Vegas earlier this year. And let me tell you, that was quite an interesting experience.
I can't imagine being in Vegas. It's like, oh, my God.
I'd rather play a board game than a one-armed bandit any day of the week.
Oh, same here. But just the sensory overload of that place must be something.
Yeah.
We look like we're, you know, sort of around the same age. Or did you grow up like an AH guy or an SPI guy? That's kind of how we, the two, or did you, were you playing when you were that young?
I actually started 50 years ago as a Sports Illustrated guy. Now, a lot of people are familiar with Sports Illustrated because of the fantastic magazine that they put out, but they actually had a line of sports games that I started playing in 1972. Pay dirt football.
Yeah, played it.
All-time all-star baseball.
Yeah.
Golf. Even tennis, decathlon.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. Avalon Hill ended up picking up a couple of those titles. And yeah.
They did.
I love sports replay games and AAH's old All-Star Replay magazine as well. I used to love that magazine.
I have them all, and your audience can't see the hat I'm wearing, but I'm wearing a Play Classic hat, and PLAAY is a sports game company. They actually came out to Tempe, Arizona, for Consum World for the first time at my encouragement. A little bit nervous, you know, how are war gamers going to react to sports games? And let me tell you, Grant, the reception was outstanding. So many people came up to us and said, oh my gosh, I started out with SI and Stratomatic, or we played face-off hockey. We played all of these games.
Face-off hockey for sure.
Oh, I have hundreds of games.
Yeah, yeah.
But they came to us and said, we sports games, oh my gosh, I've never heard of you. And now these sports games from Play have become a regular staple of my gaming diet.
Well, when you think of the guys back at Avalon Hill, like one of their big things in the office was their yearly football strategy league, right? They were like, they're all a bunch of war gamers, but they all loved sports games as well, and I'm no different. I played all those Status Pro games, all the Stratomatic games, Face Hawk Hockey, seasons and seasons and seasons of that.
Good stuff. I heard that Don Greenwood, his very favorite game was football strategy.
That totally makes sense, because when he was running that company, they would write it up in the general who won the championship every war. You know, those guys were serious about that game.
So too funny. So sports games was great, and then like most other people, I discovered Avalon Hill. It was Panzerblitz, iconic box cover. And then one day at my local hobby shop, they had an issue of S&T, and I'm like, wow, what was this? And I subscribed. And I could still remember the first issue. It was number 49, Frederick the Great, which is a game that Avalon Hill also bought and put out in a box. And from then on, it's been a passionate love affair that I enjoy so much.
Yeah, if you were an AH guy, you got a lot of the great SPI games anyway, because a lot of those good games, they would purchase them from SPI and republish them. Games like Panzer Army Africa or Guderian, some of those games that started out.
Conquistador from Richard Burr.
Yeah, that's right.
Another popular popular game, Frederick the Great, was in there.
Yeah.
So Avalon Hill cherry-picked some of the games from SPI, but I love the old flat trays, and your listeners that have been in the hobby for a while, those classic SPI flat trays that have now browned and crumbled and pretty much fallen apart. But that's okay. They still stay in sight because the memories that they evoke.
Well, and the Redmond Simonson's maps from those original games are like, you can pull those out and look at them and take a course in graphic design and map making as well.
Remember, those were pre-computer.
Yeah.
It was just incredible what he could do with two or three colors. Just stunning. So I have a vast SPI collection. A lot of it's for nostalgia. I really don't play too many SPI games. And where I did play one of their Great Battles of the American Civil War, a game, Drive on Washington, which came in a little small one-inch box. I did play that earlier this year. I had a great time.
Well, thinking back about those old games, I'm not so much interested in what was the first war game you ever played, but what was the first war game you played that like you just couldn't quit playing? It was just like became your obsession.
1976 Terrible Swift Sword from SPI and Richard Berg.
Right, yeah.
I was a teenager, and I had a friend locally, same town, and we set up the map, and over the course of many sessions, we played the entire first day, and that was the game that left me with a feeling of entrancement, but also exhaustion at the same time. And the combination of those two things are very powerful. Feeling.
Yeah. It's I remember when that game came out, it was suddenly the game that everybody was talking about. It was this revelation in the hobby, sort of. It's like, oh my God, have you played Terrible Swift Sword?
Yeah, not the first monster game, Terrible Swift Sword, with that iconic Redmond Simonson cover of the flat tray. That game was not the first monster game. I actually bought La Bataille de la Moscova, from Marshall Enterprises the prior year, came in a Ziploc bag. And then GDW had done their Drongnok Osten and Unentscheiden Europa games. So while Terrible Sword was not the first Monster game, you are 100% correct. It's the game that made a huge splash in the hobby. And I don't know how many people remember this, but when SPI and Richard Berg had the game come out, they didn't have the units rated for morale. So your bigger units had the better morale because you had to roll a dice if it was less than or equal to morale. And your smaller units, like, you know, some of the famous brigades, they were the weakest because they had the smallest strength.
Right.
When in history, it's the other way around.
Right.
So in Moves Magazine, they had a rush emergency, and Richard put out a sheet rating all the units. So I still remember getting that black marker.
Rewriting on the counters.
It was. But what a phenomenal game. And you want to talk about maps. That game had three multicolor maps that if I can get away with it, I would have mounted on my wall.
Right, right.
Right now at home. And it also planted that seed for the American Civil War, and something we'll talk about later on why I'm so involved in Blind Swords from Revolution right now. The seed goes back 45 years.
It felt like that, and was it Bloody April? It was like there was all of a sudden this resurgence of interest suddenly in American Civil War games that started with Terrible Swift Sword. That it had been, you know, everything had been, it felt like everything had been Bulge and East Front for a while in the mid-70s, or even Squad Leader had come out just before that, and then all of a sudden it was like, oh right, the ACW, look at this.
Huge. And it's the same thing, I believe, that Paths of Glory back in 99 did the same thing for World War One. And I remember being with Gene at a Strategic Con, and he said, Steve, can you come over here for a second? So he showed me this game. He goes, it's called Paths of Glory, and what do you think? And so we spent some time, we went through it, and I go, Gene, this is going to be a huge hit. I don't know. It's World War One, not very popular. And look what Paths of Glory did. But Terrible Swift Sword is the iconic game to me. It's not the best game on the American Civil War, but it is certainly the iconic game.
Absolutely. Sort of on a related subject, do you have a favorite designer? Like somebody that you just is 100%, you buy anything or you track down anything of theirs just because it's just hits you in the, you know, like that warm spot somehow that never lets you down?
Not particularly, but if I had to pick one, it probably would be Richard Berg, and that may be a little bit controversial, you know, because I know Richard had some difficulties here and there. He was very opinionated, but the guy was a Renaissance man, and he was a genius. And even on some of his games that I didn't like, you know what I found out, Grant? I still got entertainment value.
Sure.
Out of them, even though I could see this was not very well developed. This was not very well thought out. Richard had a line of games that he self-published called BSO. I don't know if you're familiar with that. They were desktop published games. We never figured out what BSO stood for because he would never tell anybody. But he issued a whole bunch of games under BSO, desktop, print and play, and they served as a testing, a proving ground for the games that he would consider, you know, to have published.
Right.
And so now you find a lot of the publishers back in the day, we're going back two decades, cherry pick these games and put these games out. So I have all of his games there. Some of them are failures, they have never been published, but even the bad ones I enjoy.
Right. Well, I really like Richard Berg as well, and the opinionated is part of what I like about him. The Renaissance man, the fact that he was like, part of my day job is I'm a stage actor, right? And you know, Richard was involved in the theater as well, right? That was
Gilbert and Sullivan.
Yeah, that's his
of
thing.
Of course,
as
he
well.
Was.
And I always thought part of the thing with whether a game was playtested or developed enough was also partly where they were being published or at what time they were being published. Like, you know, some of that SPI stuff, it felt like it was just coming out the door so fast, and you know, it didn't always feel like it got as much love as it needed because they had a deadline. It has to be by now. no questions asked.
Yeah, they had a system going in. And the old joke in the hobby is, right, like I would buy two Avalon Hill games a year, and I'd write a letter to Avalon Hill, and I'd get a reply back in 60 days, and I still have that letter in my Avalon Hill game. And then the SPI game, you know, I would go to my hobby shop, and I'm not kidding you, they had flat trays stacked 4 feet high, and I could go through and pick any game that I want, and there were just dozens and dozens, and they were all over the place. So it's the old quantity versus quality issue that still is in the hobby
right.
today.
Yeah, yeah.
We could talk about Company X's quantity, Company X's quality, but we won't do that today.
Yeah, yeah,
but
yeah.
It's still here, and it does. Every gamer, you know, do you want to go to fast food and have a McDonald's, or do you want to go to, you know, a sit down fancy restaurant? They both work for us at different times,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, well, there's a different price point sometimes too.
Sure.
The problem is the Company X that charges the steak dinner price for the McDonald's quality.
And that's happening today,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, that happens. But that happens in everything. You mentioned some of your favorite older games. Are there any older games that you still play, or are you sort of fixate, or how much time do you have to play anymore? Is it all sort of taken up with design, or, you know?
Well, I have plenty of time to play and design. I'm retired, so I pretty much set my own schedule. And what's tough, Grant, is once I start designing a game, and I don't consider myself a designer. I consider myself a player that occasionally designs.
Right.
When I go to design a game, and again, we'll talk about this with Blind Swords later, it's almost a manic consumption for me. I go all out. I'll read 5 books at the same time.
Right.
You know, I'll parallel, you know, so-and-so's book on the opening battle or the opening engagement at Shiloh, and then I'll go to another book, and I'll kind of, it's kind of like a rolling barrage. I'll do it. So it becomes manic for me.
So all-consuming.
Yeah, it really does. But it helps me in a way because I get the work done that needs to be done. But I still have a cadre of good friends that I play with. I love coming to conventions and playing games. So, yeah, I do play a lot of games, mostly solitaire,
yeah.
Late at night or maybe on a break. I enjoy the stuff from White Dog Games. I don't know if you're familiar with them.
Yeah.
They have some good games. Hollenspiel.
Yeah.
I have a good catalog of their games. Revolution War Games. GMT, of course.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to balance that design versus play and yet keep your life going. And it's not easy, but...
No, I think it's a common thing for designers when they're in process, when there's a project, like it can be consuming. It's the same thing, I think, with novelists or playwrights or what have you. Like, when you're in the creative process, it's sort of hard to get that out of your head and make space for anything else.
So true, because, again, it is consumed. It becomes almost an OCD thing. But I recognize it, and I understand it. My family understands
right.
it. And I'm able to get the work done that needs to be done, and that's richly satisfying.
Well, I'm glad you got a supportive family that way, that, you know, understands that,
very
that
important.
Period of... I think OCD is kind of not a bad way to put it, because it gets a bit, or manic even. It's sort of like it's all encompassing for sure. So you're a freelance designer,
yes.
developer.
Yes.
Tell me about a few of the hats you wear around the hobby. You've done stuff for GMT, for C3I, for Revolution, for all sorts of different publishers or producers.
Correct. And it's not so much, Grant, that I have a favorite, but it's more where my interest level lies. So Roger McGowan at C3I has been extremely kind to me. He's helped guide me, and Roger helped me gain a better understanding of the hobby. So what I do for him is I'm basically a scout. I enjoy finding articles. Hollenspiel had a couple of scenarios in their, I believe it's their number one bestseller, Table Battles.
Yeah, yeah.
And there were a couple scenarios in C3I, and it was kind of an odd thing when I approached Roger and said, hey, you know what, I'd like to get Hollenspiel to put a couple. And Roger said, go for it. If you trust it, I haven't heard of it, but if you trust it, go for it. So that's what I'm looking for. I enjoy putting my time and energy into companies that appreciate that. companies that I respect, the owners and the people that work there.
Holland Spiel's great. And such a small publisher with their print-on-demand model, it's nice to see them get like a little boost from the PR that they'll get from being in a thing like C3I.
Exactly. But I've also done, you know, work for GMT. I wrote the extended example of play for Fire in the Lake. That took 2 weeks.
Yeah.
But, you know, Mark and Volko supported me on that, and I really enjoyed doing that. It was a lot of fun. I did some work for Kevin Zucker and OSG quite a while ago. Worthington Games, I recently had my Malta Besieged game, which is a solitaire state to siege, and I realize it's not for everyone. I enjoy it because of the narrative.
I think that the people who are into States of Siege type games, I think that's the draw, really, is the narrative, is the story that those games tell.
Huge. And, you know, we include the liner notes on every single card so that people know what's happening. I started with my first game was We Must Tell the Emperor for Victory Point Games, which won the Charles Roberts Award, which was very nice.
People love that game.
Yeah, and it sells for way too much. The question I've probably been asked 100 times, if I've been asked once, is when is Emperor going to be reprinted?
Right. And what's the answer?
Yeah, I have 6 publishers lined up, really, and I've given them all the same answers. I have a handshake agreement with a publisher here in the U.S., and when the time is right, when that enthusiasm and that manic phase to get back into the Pacific War of World War II strikes, and then it will be done. It may be 2 years, it may be 5 years.
Right, right.
I don't know.
People want it.
I know. But to answer your question, I enjoy being a journeyman. I like, you know, I like traveling the country. And when I work for different companies and I'm able to develop, I'm able to edit, I'm able to write, I'm able to create. That's what keeps me going. So that's what I enjoy.
You've done some writing for C3I as well.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Enjoy the magazine. I think it's the finest magazine in the hobby, if I can say that.
Yeah.
I really enjoy it a lot.
I don't think anybody's going to dispute that.
It's awesome.
But you're also designing right now. You're very involved with the Blind Swords system that Herman Luttman designed the first one. But how many of the subsequent volumes have you worked on?
Just one. You know, and it's funny, Grant, when Stonewall Sword came out in 2015, it was the first Blind Swords game. And I had known Herman, and I liked Herman, and I liked Herman's vision. But I just couldn't get into the combat. I had some trouble with it. I sat down with a buddy, and it's a two-tiered combat system. We had a little difficulty with it, so I kind of put it off on the shelf. And then a game called Thunder in the Ozarks came out. That was also from Herman.
Yeah, you played them both, yeah.
And Roger Miller. And I like, wow. And we're like, holy moly, this is really something special. And then they go to Longstreak Attacks, which was Herman. Two Kernstown games from Claude Whelan came out. And then just last year, Revolution did something that I thought was very smart. They double printed 2 games, This Day Is Ours, which is Bull Run, and Thunder at Dawn, which is Wilson's Creek. And both of those games are extraordinarily appealing. They're very well done. I know some people don't like the Rick Barber maps.
You do or you don't, but if you do, you love them.
Rick Barber is a true artist in the hobby. I mean, he is an artist. He could be in any field and he would be an artist.
Yeah.
I found his maps a little bit overdone, a little bit too much color.
They're very bright, no doubt about it.
They're very bright, but to Revolution's credit, they have an artist now that I'm not sure how many people have heard of. His name is Edmund Hudson. And what Edmund has done is he's captured the feel of a Rick Barber map, but he's given the map functionality.
Right.
There are no questions about height or terrain. So with those two things in mind, you know, the difficulty over the combat resolution and the artistry, if anybody maybe gave Blind Swords a try earlier in the day and they weren't too sure, I strongly, heartily recommend, come on back. Take a second look. Because that's what I did.
Yeah. I found the two-step thing weird when I first started playing, but then when it started to click, I just couldn't get enough. And the combination of the chit pull, but with the events, the chits not just being the unit activations, but also the event possibilities, that made for such a rich stew in that in the cup that no two turns are the same, and it's I just can't quit playing that system.
And it plays very well solitaire. Two-player, I probably only have about 15 plays total, not including my games, but in other games, so maybe 15 games. But let me tell you, those are great games. I can't really count too many series that I've played 15 times. But it's the typical thing, Grant, where you start off as a fan, and then you become a designer, and right before Bull Run and Wilson's Creek came out from Revolution, I had started researching South Mountain.
Right.
And South Mountain is a very interesting battle because it's 3 days before Antietam. And everybody knows about Antietam, right? It's one of the marquee battles, the bloodiest day.
Yeah.
Everybody knows that. But I became fascinated with Antietam, or South Mountain. And I approached Roger Miller, and as I've posted several times, he supported me from day one. He goes, Steve, I've been asking you to design a game for me for 10 years. If it's time, it's time. And the game just came out last week. I talked to Roger and Richard from Revolution today. The game is selling fantastic.
Yeah, I got to get my copy while it's still, while it's here.
We're going to get you one. They just sold 60 more to France, 40 more to Germany or England or something. So the game is selling exceptionally well. I'm very, very pleased to hear that because we put a lot of hard work into
it.
But it comes down to Revolution Games having, and it's going to sound like an advertisement, but again, remember, I'm a fan. I'm not an employee.
Yeah.
A company that publishes a quality product. When you get a Revolution game, you're not playing roulette. You're not spinning the wheel or rolling the dice. You know the exact number on that roulette wheel that you're getting because they put the game through the old Avalon Hill style, setting up the game, playing the game 30 times.
Yeah. I'm with you. Revolution is one of my favorite publishers. When I first started doing this, you know, the podcast and the YouTube and stuff like that, and I let them know that I was doing that, and they said, you know, do you want to, can we send you something that you could review? And it's like, well, I'll have to look because I kind of already bought just about everything in your catalog because I like you guys so much. You know, it's like you said, you can't go wrong with the there's no duds in that catalog. It's all tried and true stuff.
Right, and they don't have you know, hundreds of games out. They have like 30 titles.
The prices are great. The fact that they also, most of those games come in a Ziploc or a box. You know, if you're strapped for cash, but buy the Ziploc. It's, you know, somebody said, I'm having trouble finding this game. I said, now it's so expensive. I said, expensive? Get the Ziploc, and they've got a sale on right now. Instead of $55, it's $35. How can you buy anything for $35?
How can you go wrong? And I'll tell you something here that I haven't discussed with other people. I'm sure they're okay with it. But I was a little bit worried on how a Greater Victory South Mountain would sell because the production cost was outrageous. And we had an internal discussion on this, and they're like, Steve, we have to price this game at a certain point to make a profit. And I was a little bit nervous. And they told me again today here at GMT, not one person has complained.
Right.
About the price of the game.
You know,
not one.
I hear that from Revolution. I'm hearing that from Legion. Like a lot of that sort of size of publisher, they are really being hit by the change in prices on the back end. It seems like, you know, we should all be ready for prices to go up a bit because at some point they got to be passed on to us, right?
It has to be. But then again, there's also an international component, Grant, because, you know, a year ago to be put on a cargo container from China was $14,000. You know what it is today? One fourth of that.
Oh, is that right?
Yes. The price has gone way down. So
we're like this.
Right, but still, we're paying for the paper in the United States. There's a paper shortage. We're paying for labor. You know, the small...
Transportation.
The transportation is huge. Gas. The number of printers is going down.
Right.
You know, So,
well, of course, because print is going out of style.
It is. Are we going to be a buggy whip one day? I don't know. But there's nothing that beats getting a new game in the mail.
Oh yeah.
Taking that shrink wrap, opening up the box, the smell, feeling the counters, looking at the map.
Opening that map the first time.
I'm a very physical person.
Yeah.
There's nothing that compares to that.
Well, let's talk about the new game a bit. What? So you said you were attracted to this because it was, it was 3 days before Antietam. What about the battle like attracts you that made me go, hey, this particular battle needs some more focus. I think the hobby's missing a good look at this.
Yeah, and there are four or five games out on South Mountain going back to West End games back in the 80s. So
right.
It's not like it's an untapped subject, and I didn't mean to
no, to
imply that. But
it's not like there's like 50 Gettysburg's games.
No, but the thought that hit me is, if we're able to game South Mountain, how would that affect Antietam 3 days later? And I found the answer when I was researching. And it's amazing because South Mountain was a battle that Robert E. Lee didn't want to fight. D.H. Hill was basically guarding the passes through the mountains. He's guarding the wagon trains. And McClellan, who had been fired by Lincoln, remember earlier, is now called back to service after the disaster at Second Bull Run the month prior, where the Union just got their clocks cleaned. And now McClellan makes a sudden march, and the Confederates who have invaded the North now all of a sudden find a Union army in the field. It's like, what are we going to do?
And led by McClellan, who nobody had ever seen move before.
Like that. And it's like, wow, how did this happen? So they're caught off guard. So you have a ragtag Confederate army guarding the key vital passes at South Mountain. And just a very short distance away, Stonewall Jackson's corps is besieging Harper Valley. There's 12,400 Union soldiers there. And that's being threatened also by McClellan. So you have this enormous, unusual dynamic of the Confederates being caught off guard by a general who hadn't earned a lot of respect in the field.
Yeah, absolutely.
While multiple operations at Harper's Ferry and the drive into Northern Territory, into Maryland, is occurring. It's an extraordinarily dynamic situation.
And is that where the action starts?
Yes.
So does that confusion or that being caught off guard feeling represented at the beginning of the game?
Oh, yes. And that's what Blind Swords excels at. And again, I understand a few people have expressed the concern over Blind Swords having a little bit too much chaos. I interpret chaos in the system as reality.
Couldn't agree more.
I do.
One of my favorite ACW games is The Guns of Gettysburg, Rachel Simmons. And it's a Gettysburg game, but the timing of every unit's arrival is completely random and also affects the victory conditions dynamically as you go. But it's sort of like, this is everybody who came, but when they came exactly, you know, is up in the air. It could have gone very different ways. I'm cool with that. I like random, I like chaos, and the less scripted the better as far as I'm concerned.
I agree, and it's great for replayability, and it's great for solitaire.
Yeah.
So the situation is extraordinarily dynamic, and so here comes these Union Corps marching, you know, against this ragtag. And what I found really interesting was researching the order of battle. And the actual letters from Robert E. Lee to Jefferson Davis survive. And he says, hey, you know, this is like maybe 5 days, six, 7 days before the battle. We've lost so many men to stragglers, because when the South went into Maryland, they expected the population to welcome them, and they didn't.
Right.
So they started to struggle for supplies. They started to struggle, and there was a tremendous amount of stragglers. So what was really tough for me, Grant, was I have the beginning of September. I have the Army rosters, and then I have the Army rosters on the 17th for Antietam. Neither one of those worked for me, because the battle 3 days before, the Confederates were suffering from such extreme stragglers that later in Antietam, even after the Battle of South Mountain, the Confederate regiments had higher muster rolls after fighting an engagement 3 days before, because the stragglers returned. So I kind of took a controversial tactic, and I went with what I thought was right. So one of the first things, comments that I got, one of my friends sent me an email, and he said, "Steve, you know, half the Confederate countersheet is blank. Well, I have a misprinted copy." And I go, "Alan, it's not misprinted. Turn it over." And on the back side of the fragile side, because they're fragile, they're under strength, they're at half strength.
They just start at that side. There's no coming back to full strength for all those units.
Now on the roster on September 1st, they show them having 800 men.
Right.
I read the colonel's report that said we fielded 350 men.
Right, and that's one of the great things about that system too, is it is all the unit strengths they give you that system lets you say these guys were less, these guys were more, these guys were completely beat. It's not all every brigade is five. You sculpt it the way you interpret the history.
Exactly. So you have 800 guys on September 1st, you have 350 on the 14th, and then they fought and they suffered casualties and missing in action. And then 3 days later, they have 500. What happened? So one of the big challenges for me, and I like having a challenge, was separating the Antietam in the beginning of September, those rosters, and separating those ingredients and refining it to getting just what I needed, like a chemical process. You filter out this. So I had a couple of guys that helped me. And it was just a lot of reading and a lot of work.
And
I enjoyed it.
How fun was it you must have taken it very seriously, obviously. But
I did.
I think one of the things that's got to be the most fun is looking at Civil War generals and whatever game you're designing or playing. They're so key, and they need a rating. And in the blind sword system, they need that rating about whether they're going to get a full activation or not. How did you approach that problem? Because that's a kind of a key to the generals in this game.
It was a lot of fun. And the way I looked at it is like naming a child. It's an honor and a privilege, because these are people that actually fought. Some of them died.
Yeah.
And so I said, it's like naming a child. I'm going to get it right. I'm not going to. So basically, it was just a lot of research. And I did look at other games. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. I have a lot of respect for the guys now that run Great Battles of the American Civil War for GMT. You've got Dick Whitaker. You've got Greg Laubach, who just put out Death Valley Shenandoah, the expansion. Dick Whitaker is the designer of Into the Woods. You've got Bill Byrne, who I met in Consum World, is an extraordinary playtester and rules editor. So their team is just phenomenal. But I went back. I'm an avid collector. I have 2,700 games. So I had a vast library to pull from. But what it comes down to, Grant, is where I felt the leader should be.
Yeah.
I didn't fudge any factors for gameplay. And it's just like rating a leader in any game. I know there are people, oh my gosh, Steve, how did you give him a 5 and him only a 3? What's wrong with you? That happens. I try not to nitpick other designers' ratings and their orders of battle, because they may have access to different sources than me. There was a source that I didn't have. The book was really expensive, but a buddy of mine did have, and he helped me out by referencing that book when I was researching Southbound. So I don't want to criticize other designers. The way I look at it is, it's your game. You name your child what other name that you want to name them.
Yeah.
I'm not going to criticize you for this or that. This is your vision. This is your baby. It's your child, and you do it. So that's how I did it.
Well, and I think that's the healthy way to look at it, because it's not like we only have room for one game. If somebody disagrees with your ratings, well, they can make their own game if they disagree so much. But, when we play your game, what we're playing the game, but we're also like having a look at the way you as the designer see the situation, see the way the battle played out. So it's sort of like historical fiction in a way, or not even historical fiction. It's sort of, in some ways, it's like your take on history.
Exactly. It's your vision. It's really no different than a song. When someone writes a song, someone makes a movie, right? You have a vision. And that's what designing a game comes down to. I don't so much look at it, Grant, as a mechanical process. Yes, the mechanics have to work, and I'm fortunate with Blind Swords because the mechanics developed by Herman Luttman are fantastic. So I already have a toolbox that I know that works.
Right.
And there's all these tools in here that I could use to create the game and to make the game playable without burdening the player with a bunch of exceptions. Bunch of special rules. Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's not what the game is about.
Well, it's such a beautiful system, and you know, obviously people are into it because we've got five or six or seven games in this system now. I know you just said that there's not many exceptions or anything like that, but were there things that you had that you felt you needed to add in as sort of chrome that to make it feel exactly like South Mountain?
Yes, and that's an excellent question, because there's a lot of things under the hood that I'm not sure, you know, you'd have to play the game, you know, 5-10 times to see that. One specific example is I divided the battlefield into two, and I used the main turnpike to do that. So the Union 9th Corps comes in on one half of the battlefield, and the Union 1st Corps comes in on the other, and there's no mingling on that. And the reason that I had to do that was because the early engagement at Fox's Gap, the Confederates had the advantage. They could have piled on all their artillery, all of their, they had their headquarters at Mountain House, which is at Turner's Gap. And right off the bat in early playtesting, the Confederates just go and they sweep it and the game's over. In the second half, the Union could just pile. I mean, the Union has so many brigades that come in. So we had this conundrum. What do you do to prevent this? And the solution was very simple. I've got a turnpike going right down the middle of the road. Historically, they use that as the divider for the command. So I'm just going to make a rule saying, now, am I handicapping you? Am I handcuffing you? Some people may see that, and I respect that.
Well, we see that a lot in World War II games too, right? And there's army dividing lines in a lot of Normandy games, for example, where it's like, yeah, this is the Sword Beach ends here, and Juno Beach starts here, you know.
And if you didn't have that, it's really open to abuse.
Yeah.
So early on, the Confederates could wipe out the Union, and then at the second half of the day, the Union is just so strong. So we had to get that balancing scale to go up and down. You know, you see your scale as you add weight to it, it goes up and down. Adding weight is adding the weight of your troops, your formations coming in. We had to balance that without it tipping over and spilling.
Right. That's a perfectly good an easy rule that solves a problem that I don't see many people complaining about. How did you deal with is there much cavalry in this engagement?
No.
Right.
No, the terrain is so brutal. South Mountain is known as probably the most rugged battlefield of the entire American Civil War.
Right. Because the Blind Sword system, some games handle cavalry one way and some a different way, depending on how much is in the engagement. So
exactly. And the cavalry did play very important roles. At South Mountain, it was not an important role. And then we'll talk about the game I'm working on now. Shiloh Cavalry was not an important role.
Right.
But at South Mountain, there's a couple of regiments that fought dismounted. And then for the Union, they had a brigade that guarded the turnpike for future reinforcements. Other than that,
right.
The terrain is so steep.
Right.
So steep. I'd like to talk about artillery for a second, if you don't mind.
Fantastic.
The terrain, and again, we adjusted the scale of the map. So when you look at the South Mountain map, when you get your game or you look at the Revolution website, you can see the wedding cake effect.
It's got
that, and we did that on purpose because the terrain and the line of sight could have been a nightmare. So we simplified it to it's 98% tied in with the core series.
Right.
So look at that wedding cake effect. So we were able to adjust that, but placing your artillery in this game is challenging, and it's a lot of fun because when you get those right spots, and I'm not going to tell you what they are. One of my play testers didn't get it till like the third game. He goes, "Oh my gosh, Steve, I get it." Once you find those spots for the artillery and you start lobbing those shells in, you feel like you're a commander at the scene. You're not reading about it happening.
Right.
You're actually doing it. And to me, that's boots on the ground.
I've had that feeling in other Blind Swords games. There's nothing more frustrating than realizing you've got your artillery in a bad spot. They're troublesome to move. But when you're in the right spot and it just seems like you can fire at him and he can't fire back at you, nothing feels better.
Yeah, and the artillery is important in the game. It is important, but because of the terrain, it's mostly an infantry battle.
Right, yeah. But that's how most of these games feel too, right? The artillery does a bit and can be integral, but it never feels like it's decisive. It always comes down to the boots on the ground.
And you have to watch. In any Civil War game, again, I won't name any specific examples, but if artillery is allowed to be used as a 19th century panzer, you know, it just didn't happen that way. I'm sorry. Unless there's an abject emergency and you're given an order, it just didn't happen that way. So when I see games where artillery, which is mostly a defensive weapon, when I see that happening, I just kind of grit my teeth and go, that Blind Swords artillery is not going to be the deciding factor in the game. It's going to be your strategy, your tactics, some chaos.
Yeah.
Some chaos and some luck, but it's an integral part of the battle.
Yeah, I was playing Clash of Giants earlier, and Ted Racer's thoughts about Civil War artillery were similar. He didn't even put the units on the board. He just assigned a possible plus one here or there. And just because it just wasn't, in his view, decisive in those battles either. So it was more of a top-up or a DRM, but not a... He was avoiding the same thing, your idea of Civil War panzer units. He said every time he put the units, made them into units, people got so focused on them and... They dominate, yeah.
It's a design for effect, and I agree with Ted 100%.
Right.
And when we talk about Shiloh... when you're ready.
Well, let's talk. So that's that. You've got one game out the door.
Just came out last week.
And yeah. Shiloh is what you're working on next?
Shiloh is a two-map game. And
is it going to be through Revolution as well?
Yes. Revolution has... they know that the Blind Sword series excels at small to medium engagements. Shiloh is a large engagement. It's one of the iconic battles of the American Civil War. A game came out earlier this year called A Most Fearful Sacrifice by Herman Luttman, and people are asking, well, why wasn't that done by Revolution? It's because the game was too big to do as Blind Swords. Nobody wants to have 60 chits in the cup.
Right.
Nobody.
He's got a new system like a Blind Swan or
Black Swan.
Black Swan, yes. I finally got my hands on a copy today.
Oh, good.
So which
it
was
sold
great.
Out.
Yeah, it sold out. But somebody who had two sold me a copy.
Well,
so
you got
good.
Lucky, Grant, yeah, because that's a good game. And Herman created a hybrid. You know, a lot of Blind Swords is in there. It's a hybrid. And they also, I don't know if you know this, Flying Pig is doing smaller battles using a very similar...
I didn't know that.
It's a combination of Blind Swords and Black Swan.
I knew that it sold out so quickly that they took the unusual step for them to decide to re-kickstart it all over again and do a second run, which is fantastic for Herman.
Because it's a good game.
Yeah. People... were crazy to get their hands on it, and then they weren't disappointed.
A playable Gettysburg game, who would have thought it?
Yeah, but
Flying Pig, which is the same company, you know, that Most Fearful Sacrifice, it's a different name, but it's the same company.
So two companies.
They're basically the
same.
So
yeah.
Champion Hill is shipping now. It's called Hill of Death, and I'm anxious to see that
from
Herman.
And Herman designed that one as
he
well.
He did.
Yeah, yeah.
So here's the challenge, and we really haven't got into it that much because it's still in the design stage, but we can get as much detail as you like. It's a challenge for two reasons. It's a two-map game, Blind Swords. And we had an internal discussion again on this. There is definitely some doubt on whether the system can carry the weight of a big game like that.
So are you trying to decide whether to go keep with Blind Swords or move towards a more of a Black Swan approach?
I'm already past that point.
Okay.
It's all Blind Swords.
Okay.
And the reason that it works
is... it's a two-map game. How many chips are going to be in the cup?
Well, not as many as you think. I am still doing some tweaking on that. And
I'm happy for chits in the cup. Don't get me wrong.
I know. I haven't got to the campaign game yet. But the one of the key factors on it is we're going to keep the game to the first day. And I've already taken some flack on that, online. Hey, that's not going to be a complete game. I'll tell you, if we're going to talk about designer's vision, the first day at Shiloh was the day of decision. I think it was Ed Beers that wrote, really nice guy, by the way, passed away just 2 years ago. Have an autographed book from him. Wrote that the battle at Shiloh was decided on April 6th. April 7th was just to determine how big a win it was going to be for
him. Right.
It's such a slog. You bring in the Army of the Ohio, and with that, it wouldn't work. The system, the game would collapse under that weight.
Well, and it's not unheard of to do it like that. I think there's other games that do just one day in Gettysburg or other I think I've seen that before, haven't we? That designers just do a one day of a 3 day engagement.
Well, even Longstreet's attacks.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
It's just part of the battle.
Yeah,
because they know that Blind Swords can't handle that much. So. Right. We're already past that point. It works if we leave out the second day. I didn't want to do the second day. I don't think it's fun to play, and it goes outside of the parameters. We're stretching the envelope as it is.
Right.
So that's one decision. The second decision was that battle out west was really the first big battle. A lot of the units were at full strength. Unlike at South Mountain, a lot of the units were reduced, especially for the south. So if you look at the numbers, the disparity is huge. And they're like, oh my God, Steve, are you going to have like 800 units? No, I'm not. You know what it is? It's an extra half a counter sheet.
Right.
Because the numbers, if I have five Confederate regiments that add up to 15 strength points, or I have one counter that adds up to 15 strength points, it's the same number of men, but five counters versus one. And at Shiloh, the regiments had nearly full rosters. There were some exceptions. Prentiss's division had just formed a couple weeks prior. Sherman's division was still outfitting. So there are a few exceptions that they weren't at full strength. So when you look at the actual numbers to a layperson, it's like, wow. But if you look at the actual number of components, it's pretty darn close.
So it's a matter of adjusting the strength of the units as the number of units?
The unit's strength is going to be fixed on the order of battle of research, which is done.
Right.
It's the number of counters are not that many more compared, because the men are actually compacted historically. It's not something that I did, which Herman did in A Most Fearful Sacrifice. They're demi-brigades, actually.
Right.
So a division may have three or four brigades, but you don't get three or four counters. You get two or three counters.
Right.
So he had to compact it.
Right.
But at Shiloh, it works, and I'm convinced Revolution is still, they told me today, Steve, it's still going to have to pass muster. Man, I go, I get it, and it will.
Right.
Because I have the vision, I know how it's going to work, and I think it's the most exciting project I've worked on. I'm really thrilled with it.
I imagine you say that on every project you're working on.
No, I don't. The first game was great. You'll never forget your first South Mountain was a joy to work on. This has been something. It's been a lot of fun.
Well, I'm always eager. I'm always eager to see more games on the West too. It seems likely there's a lot of focus on the East in Civil War games. So this is great. I think it's a great topic.
Well, you're going to get Perryville also.
Yeah, this
is the next game.
Yeah.
by Jeff Grossman. Jeff Grossman, to those not familiar, designed a tremendously popular game for GMT called Cuba Libre.
Yeah, great game.
Wow, what a game.
Love that game.
So he's the designer of Perryville. We play tested it at Consum World. Fantastic. We play tested it here today. Fantastic. I think it's going to be a great game. And Blind Swords, Grant, is one of those series that goes against not common logic, that just goes against what we normally see, where a series comes out, the first game's really popular, right? The second game maybe sells quite a few, but it's not going to sell as much as the first game.
Right.
And now you start seeing that slope going down. Blind Swords is the opposite.
Right.
They've actually shown me the records, the books.
Each game is getting more and more popular.
Yeah, and
right?
it's phenomenal. So yeah. How often do you see that
right.
happening in the hobby?
Well, people talk about the Blind Sword system a lot. It's got a lot of love. Like, and you know, it's the first game was 2015. So it's not that old, but it's people are. I can see why it's increasing because. I hear that chatter all over the place. Like when you say you're playing a Blind Swords game, people will say to you, oh my God, yeah, I love that. I love that.
We get it all the time. Wherever we go, it's the same comment every time. It's exactly the same.
Well, I got to get South Mountain, but now you got me excited about Shiloh.
well, get them both and get Perryville and get the games in the back catalog. They all stand the test of time.
I have all of the Blind Swords except one. I got to get one more and then
okay.
I'm good. Yeah, like I'm a sold. You got the hook deep in my cheek. That's what I'll say.
You know how in the old days people used to and then we still do. We display our favorite books on our. On my limited gaming space inside of the house, most of my games are in my garage, but they occupy the shelf of pride.
The first game
didn't come in a box, Stonewall Sword, so that's in a bag on top, and then I've got.
My own box.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
A white box.
a white box, and then I printed the cover, and yeah.
So there they are stacked, and every time I come home, I'm looking, I'm just like. Thumbs up.
Yeah. So do you think, so this will be two Blind Swords games for you. Is it possible to look ahead and think if you got any more Blind Swords in you?
Not at this time.
Right.
There's something in the back of my mind, but I'm not going to even think about it right now because, again, I get manic. I get so focused.
You're so far in Shiloh right now that's all there is.
It just, and I was the same way with South Mountain. I'll double check. I'll triple check. I'll think of a rule in the middle of the night. I keep a sticky pad and a pen, and I wake up and literally I'll write a note. And even sometimes I'll wake up at 3:30 and I'll go to the computer and I'll type it in because I don't want to forget that.
Great songwriters talk about doing that all the time. Yeah, they keep a thing in their pocket. They keep a thing by their bed. They don't want to let a good lyric. Come in and go.
So it goes into that OCD category again. And you know, there's no such thing as a perfect game. One of Richard Berg's famous lines, you may have heard before, that a board game is never finished. It's only released.
Yeah, that's right. It's the same thing about a novel or a play. You don't finish it. You just, at some point, have to quit and give it over.
Yeah. It's an extraordinarily, this hobby is an extraordinarily cathartic, an extraordinary, exciting a thing to be involved in as a player. And as me, I'm kind of like a journeyman again. You know, I'm that guy on the baseball team that can play right field, but can come in and catch if you need be. You know, that's the role that I relish and that I enjoy. It's just something that to me is unique.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you, Steve. Is there anything else that we didn't get to that you wanted to touch on?
No, just welcome. Welcome your first time. This convention has been a staple for me for over 20 years.
I've met nothing but nice folks here.
Gene does a wonderful job keeping this going. It was a tough choice during the pandemic. The staff that they have here, the people that show up here, to me, the highlight is not so much the games, it's the people. I mean, it's just extraordinary, the knowledge that people have and the things that they want to talk about. It's a social experience. It's a learning experience. And again, you get half, very cathartic for me, but also, as your listeners have heard me talked for the vast majority of this, and thank you for that. I get excited and I relish the role.
Yeah, I've heard that from so many people here, and even getting ready to come, you know, I was in contact with a few people online, and they said exactly what you said. It's like, this is my yearly homecoming. These are my people.
You look forward to it. You know, in the old days, family reunion.
Yeah.
Now, get me to GMT, get me to Consum World, get me out to Dice Tower, wherever I can play games and meet good people. It's a win-win.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
All right. It's been a pleasure. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Okay. I hope you enjoyed that interview with Steve Carey as much as I did. Time for a few bouquets or brickbats. Bouquets this time. My hat goes off to something a bit specific to Canadian wargamers. If you're a Canuck and you're frustrated by American producers who won't ship to Canada, I finally found a workaround. It's especially great if you live in Toronto or Vancouver in particular, but it'll work for the rest of us as well. They're called Shipsy.com. That's with two P's, Shipsy.com. And how it works is you get your game shipped to their U.S. address. They bring it across the border. And then if you live in Toronto or Vancouver, you can go pick it up. And it only costs about, I think, $7. If you live elsewhere, you can have them mail it via Canada Post once it makes it to Canada. So a little more expensive, but it might be the difference between getting a gem and missing out. So check it out, Shipsy.com. I could have used this in the past. I'm definitely going to use it in the future. As for parting shots this episode, not really. Nothing to do with the industry, really, other than are you a Twitter user? I am. I found it to be a supportive, positive spot for my war game habit and hobby. I don't do much on Facebook as I find that a bit too toxic. There's too many folks throwing around words like snowflake and woke and complaining that you can't say anything anymore. I found Twitter to be the obvious. Maybe it's just, or the opposite. Maybe it's just by keeping my Twitter focused on wargaming, and I have another personal account that I use otherwise. But the one that's focused on wargaming, it's mostly the opposite of that that toxicity. It's focused on the wargaming without a lot of intervention. So I'm a little worried about it as I record this. Elon Musk seems intent on flushing $44 billion down the toilet. Here's hoping it lasts. Hit me up at, I'm at Cardboard Pusher on Twitter, while you still can. I'm also checking out Mastodon and Counter.social, which looks a lot like Twitter in some ways. So you can check that out as well, too. Anyway, if Twitter implodes, we'll all need a new place to meet. So just keep your options open. In the meantime, there's always my website, pushingcardboard.com, as well. It's been livelier lately than usual, so you can check that out. And we have a Discord server. You can find a link to that on our website, or probably through Discord search, I imagine. Anyway, thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the interview with Steve. And if you enjoyed it, tell a friend. If you have time, leave a review on iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts. Apparently that really helps extend the reach. I learned that I'm up to number 27 in the games category in Ireland. So who knew? Anyway, leave a review. Talk to you next time.